read out in a while. Never was off the place until he was 21. He bought it. Took him into town, bought him a suit of clothes, including a necktie, and left him standing on the street corner while he went up to, around the village to investigate the iniquity of the town. The boy stood there for an hour, it seemed like, and passerby walked up to him and asked him what he was doing. Oh, I'm sorry. They threw me his necktie. I thought I was tied up.
Oh my God.
More in the woods that, that were taken along about that period of time too. There's some writings on the back of them. And then in this same little bunch here, there's a picture that came down from my mother's side of the family that shows the old McCullough house, which is up in the head of Scobbins Valley, about 4 miles distant from the Tile Place. And she says on here the lumber in the front part of the house was cut by the famous old Cornelius mill before 1900. And that flat house was destroyed by fire. I don't remember it at all. But the picture of it here, and along with it, one of the reasons, besides this being history, that I included this in this group is that both of the McCullough boys, Frank and Felix, were also associated with the fire patrol in the early days in which our family was taking part in it. And along with this is a picture of Granddad McCullough being interviewed by Tom McCall, who was reported for the Oregonian at that time on Granddad's 100th birthday. So I think I'll read you this card from which my great grandma owns to Cecil River in 1912. Dear grandson, how glad I am the time is drawing near that I will get to see your dear face again, if it is God's will. How thankful I was to hear you and your friends escape unhurt by that dread of the full fire, and the cutting the spelling just dreadly all to us. May God still watch over you and bring you home safe is my daily prayer. Mommy fixing to have strawberry shortcake for dinner. I wish you was here to help me get with lots of love, and God bless you, Grandma. So that's kind of a prayer. I think I'll just pass this around. And I just try to do the same rest of these, a lot of this picture along the woods, and I want to make a few comments about it, and just put it for passing around. Well, Thank you. what happened in 1910. There was 511,000 acre farm, contained 2 billion board feet of timber. The firefighting costs were $303,951, and the state's cost portion of that was $250, which they spent the postage. That's all I'm starting to get organized.
Were these fires naturally caused or man caused?
It seemed like the bulk of the occasional ones were lightning, but the bulk of them were largely caused by a man flaring and series of bad fire conditions. During those years, we were choked up by the smoke from one was an awful lot in the summertime. Yeah, sure. Well, some of my recollections, we came to Fort Grove here about 1925. Dad had worked down northwest part of the state for the Forest Service in various capacities before that time. The headquarters at that time was, it used to be First Avenue South. What do you call it now?
19th.
It was down in that house, down next to the state highway department. And the office was just simply in our house in the beginning. It was a little garage beside some type of garage. And shortly after that, I built a two-car garage with a loft upstairs to store tools and a little alleyway in the back to for kind of a shop to work on hand tools and pumps and refit hoses and that sort of thing. A little bit later, they bought a house. We've got an art house right across the creek from that. I think that was purchased from a man by the name of Shu Wei. I remember writing up the earnest money receipt on him. They say looking at yourself and that time that was just beginning to run tight a little bit. And that remained there as a headquarters location until about 1937, I think, when this layout was built out here on the field of the road. And of course, there was a crew stayed there, summer months, smoke chasers, they called them in those days. Head administrator was called a district warden, and there was another year-round man, who was called the inspector, and his duties were largely law enforcement work. Main duties consisted of sawmill and logging operations, and seeing that they had fire tools on hand during the fire. and she would go to the home and check logs off this. And of course the cops came in and they had a fire extinguisher and that control. Sawmills had to define their slab fires by putting like a metal fence around them. Whenever the fire got outside of that particular fence where they were supposed to put it out, the fireworks came around, so they were trying to keep it contained. Later on, they went to fire the wigwam with burners and finally now, I guess they got old and they were able to do the DQ, so. And my first experience out in the woods, long before I was old enough to work, a friend that had a, what they call a patrol or a beat, which he rode every day during the fire season from the farm out to usually up to a very quick view of the stage down what we call Fisher Cabin on Neal Street. My brother and I spent a lot of time with our grandparents in those early years. My mother taught and she would frequently go to summer school and the teaching career. But anyway, granddad had this patrol to make and many a time brother and I ride double on one horse and he rides good saddle there. One year I remember they had the fire patrol used to keep the horse up there too, but sometimes they had over to the Crown place over here. It's been a long time now, I guess they call them Crown. But he'd ride out to this third grade view, which in those days you could it was pretty clear to see all over the head of the elevator, the dog crit around in there. And of course Grandma always picked it up a bit much and it was a very cold spring right up there close to the top of the mountain where we went. I remember Grandad lie down and take a nap. And he'd go back up and take another look. Then we'd ride back to the ranch. And we used to go out to the men on trail work and watch them work and learn how to run the old cross-cut saws and work on the phone lines, stuff like that. Some of it I was 14, I didn't get paid for it, but I got set up to the Brown place with the patrolman up there, who was Thad Stevenson, so some of you remember him. And I spent summer with him up there, and kind of his patrol was to down to University Falls. And one day and back up towards Tub Springs, we went out to the top of the bike, we were bringing down on the Hill Street side again. We'd go one way, another one. Kind of split that up with him. And one of us would go one way one day, and then we'd trade it out. And the other would go that way, and it kind of made a little more coverage of the territory. And one thing that stands out in my mind of the past is that year Tom was, Tom Stevenson was on Saddle Mountain Lookout, and he got a ulcerated tooth and had to come out. This was long, way late in the afternoon, and just about to almost getting dark, I'd say, when Tom started down. They decided that I should take the mare, which they used there, in fact, to fly it up to look out and take it up to meet Tom on the trail so they wouldn't have to walk all the way. So I started out and had just a little bit of a pen light flashlight with me. And as soon as I could hit the 8 to 10 of my dark, couldn't see anything, I'd flash the light on once in a while. I'd see us still on the phone line and keep going. We got about halfway up there. There'd been some engineers working in there that summer. There was a warehouse there, I think. And they had a camp at a little spring down off the trail a little way. The old mare had been up there the day before, and they had taken her down there to give her a drink. Well, she was in there. And Tom took a drink. And I wasn't even aware of the existence of that trail. She raised up her head, and I kicked her in the ribs and all out into the brush. She went. And that time I looked at the phone line, it wasn't there. So I immediately tied up and knew there was no use to hunt for it in the dark. And I started hollering as loud as I could. And I told him, probably was pretty close to Tom, probably heard that he couldn't answer. He was ulcerated too. So I unsaddled, built a little fire, covered up the saddle blanket. Way down there in the morning, on about daylight, where there comes a couple guys with a lantern looking for me. The pump didn't get much help. And that summer, that crew, part of the time stayed right there around the rear place. They were. Running section lines and what we call taking foot pods. They carry little barometers with them and they do the sort of contour lines to the ground. And I would sometimes go out with them, practice by pacing, check with them, and see how I'm going to accomplish work. I think some of that work went into this map that is hanging on the wall here. The part that I had in it came later on after I started school. We summer. 1936. Another fellow and I did a lot of triangulation work, tying in section corners to the government triangulation points. This was done in cooperation with the U.S. Forest Service. They had crews doing the same thing. But, and I don't know whether there was ever any, whether some of that was done with aerial photography or not. It hadn't come in very strong at that time, and I don't see how they would ever piece it together very well. And while we're on that phase of work, here's something around this part of the country where I had occasion to retrace some that he did way back the years that he was teaching and practicing some way on the side.
That's
Glenwood area, I think my brother and one of his buddies, Harold Bateman, carried water for the crews. And 1933, I went to work in earnest. I was sent up to Baseline Lookout, which was on the ridge out west of Cherry Grove between Pollock and the Scoggins waters. And it was about 6 miles down this way from Saddle, and it was right above where Stimson's camp was later. I don't lie there in the same creek, Scoggins creek. And I got a picture of the cabin, the way it was then, which I will pass around. There's some other pictures attached to it, which I'll explain a little bit about it this time. There's one of me on the 39 fire. I grew up there at Old Camp One, and then another, me and my family, quite a few years later, when we were over 2 years, they kind of go together. I'll tell you a little bit more about that. Great teachers.
There's a whole bunch of people. Did you go to Oregon State? No,
yes.
Or Park State?
Stuart Holbrook wrote a book called Burning an Empire, and he devoted a chapter with some good stuff on the 33 fire, but he also, in that book, mentioned the history of several really large fires in the United States, which I think is worthwhile comparing. And the first one that he mentioned was one in 1825 in New Brunswick in Maine, burnt 4,700 square miles, 160 lives lost, back in 1825. And this was caused by numerous flaring fires, including all of these. Another one in 1881, Michigan, caused land flaring fires, including all of these. 1,500 square miles, 169 lives lost. O2 and Yakov burned. I just didn't get the site down on that one. another great fire, well, 1970. When that, she was, there was one that was caused by life, and there was one life lost on that, and it burned 135 square miles. And while I was looking at that, I also ran across an interesting bit of article that was put together by the Historical Society. About a fire in 1902 in Bridalveil area. The title of it was Oxen, Axes, and China Teacups, put together by J.A. Woodward. And this fire was started on the railroad down on the main line, I think it was the old DRN, and Palmer was a little sawmill town, only a few miles back up in the hills off the river on the Oregon side. And the Palmer Lumber Company began operations there in about 1880, and there were two lives lost. On this particular fire, and then there was an account of a fire written by a sixth grader, and he tells about where the house was up on the hill. Incidentally, the two lives that were lost, were his schoolmates, and all the mill crew saved themselves by jumping in the pond. And this kid wrote this article. His home was up on the hill a little ways above the mill. And they traveled for the way several days, just traveling through the woods to the various farmsteads to try to get away from the fire. Well, there was one stretch of about 5 miles where they picked up another farm. Except with another farm family in a wagon, and there wasn't room for all of them to ride, so they take turns riding and the other running behind the wagon to keep them on fire. And he said they slept under two of them slept under one blanket for several nights, and the smoke was really suffocating. When the pilot did come back to the site, of course, the mill was nothing but a mass of twisted steel, but their house was left standing. And the Historical Society, if you're not familiar with that, the Historical Society did a bunch of digs in there in connection with this article. Of course, it all grown back up to forest again in the 1970s, but they dug out a tremendous amount of artifacts from the sawmill site and the various houses and buildings around there. And it's good. There's a lot of that. Well, back to 1933. I was on baseline lookout to a fire hose over the head of Yale Street, 14th of August. And of course, everybody's line was almost immediately evacuated. It was evacuated the next day, and I think everybody else down in Wilson River. Settlement, trash lookout, and so on. And so I spent the duration of that fire in the office, and as a dispatcher, taking in receiving messages, and There's about five or six, I think there's six fire wardens based there. The purpose of leading crews out on fires, and I had put in one shift on the phone, and another seemed like a full shift. I had to get up and get breakfast for those guys every morning. And the one time the day started about 2 o'clock. And there's a lot of little things I can tell you. There's Lynn Cronenberg, who was state partner at that time, spent a lot of time there. And I remember one time that the fire was really poking up over on the west side. Nobody knew where it was at. So if you wanted Dad to go up in a plane and just get an eyeball view of where it was at, how it looked like we were heading. And of course, you had to go into Portland to get a plane. I remember calling on a writing and signed a personal check for him to pay for the plane ride and said, "Don't make it for more than $800, that's all I got." And we had a guy there in the office who was keeping track of things from the U.S. Forest Service out in Washington, D.C. And he was kind of a jolly sort of a guy. I remember we had an old leather, upholstered leather chair with some springs sticking out of it. He found an old Ford coil around there someplace and wired those springs up to that chair to catch anybody to get filled up, come in, give them a bite. We had three of those fires, 33 fire covered. I never did get my calculator out to check on it. I think we figured around 300,000 acres in this article. And I believe this is out of Holbrook. It's 375 square miles. And 300 square miles and 39 and 284 miles in 45. 12 billion board feet was the estimated to be the green timber kill in the first fire, and not nearly so much in the others because they burned over bulk of the same area. They did spread out the boundaries in various places and took in a little area that hadn't been burned before. They were a little smaller fire, so there was only 39 that figured 834,440,000. And this 12 billion, one article explained it that it's being enough timber to keep all the mills that were operating at that time for a year. I went down to Western Lane County in 1937, since I got out of school and was assistant district warden down there. And I was there several years. 39, they called me back up here, and I ran camp on the 39 fire, and had a crew of about 200 men to, out of Perryville. And we were working clear back up on the old Florida line, about an hour and a half drive to get back up in there, and put a hike out on the fire line to go. So I moved on up to Camp 1. Medical discharge from the Army. didn't want to come in the first place. They thought they'd done their best, you know, they'd seen action, and they were medical cases and all kinds of things. And those guys that were told, they were all high up, and guys, of course, the cooks take pity on them, and they were just probably a small part of the whole brigade. And, see, 45, then I was there a couple of weeks. That fire was the longest duration. That one lasted, according to these statistics, 53 days, whereas the 33 fire, the bulk of it burned in 12 days. In fact, 270,000 acres of that 300,000 burned in a 20-hour period, 24th of August. And 39 fire, 17 days. So, 45 was much longer duration. So I was relieved from that after a couple of weeks, and we just got back down. I'd been inspector on the Toledo district at that time. I just got home and got a bath and started to work up my maps and notes of what I had done. And so Nels Rogers, State Forest, and he says, we gotta have you over Black Rock. There, we fired going over there, and I was out of Dallas, around Dallas. And he says, District Warden Cam Hammond, he's all nervous, he goes to his bottom, and he wants to be relieved. They didn't lay him off, they let him do a special work or something. He says, you come on over. He says, you can have the district if you want. So, of course, I got a well better goal. I spent the rest of that summer on the block. We did get it. We did get fire. Okay. And, but he told me that as I said, I had a district in by long, but after I got over there, I soon saw that he didn't mean it. He began addressing me as acting. That winter, I was transferred over to Eastern Oregon and spent the rest of my career in the State Service on the Central Oregon District over there. And I had a lot of, well, it's just a lot of amusing little incidents that I wanted to tell you about, but I think that they're kind of knocked this off. So, while I was at Kinzu, I had a fellow working for me who was an understudy for a guy who had built all the telephone systems in that part of the country, all the way back to the beginning of the 19-teens. He was the original owner was wanted to retire and sell out, and he wanted Bob, and he was to take over for him. Bob didn't have much money, and he tried to get his